fairly well educated on corporations and how it works, and yet I find it quite confusing when I get the shareholders' reports and the whole proxy system. I'm aware of how the proxy system works now, but when I see some of my friends, they just send in their proxy just thinking that they must do that in order to hold a meeting. And sometimes, it's from my perception in Cook Inlet region, it's kind of hard to make generalizations because each region is different and each region is unique, but Cook Inlet region is an urban region in Anchorage. But it's my perception that somehow, or many times, the board of directors may not speak for the shareholders, and the shareholders are unaware of how they could really get effective input into the corporation. Whether people agree or disagree with me, I wish they'd come up and say, but that's just my personal opinion. What is the purpose of the corporations is something which a lot of the corporations are thinking of now. We hear about how successful corporations are. I hear about how successful Cook Inlet region is, but yet when it comes to providing jobs for shareholders, I don't see much at all. Roy Hundorf was in our class talking about 2-3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, and we have approximately 6,300 shareholders, and of that, the corporation only employs 25 shareholders. We do get dividends, checks, but it's a question as to what is success, you know, what is successful for a corporation. Some of the other corporations I see may not be doing as well economically, but they are doing quite well at providing jobs for their shareholders. The whole issue of stock in 1991 and stock alienation, if other native groups are going to be looking at ANCSA and trying to find a settlement in some of the other areas, I understand the James Bay and the Northern Quebec settlement was based on ANCSA, and also I think there was one in Northern Australia. I would encourage that they don't have stock ownership, but rather have a membership organization. I think you would eliminate problems like the Afterburns if it was just a membership organization, and if you were part of the Native community, when you were born into the Native community, then you would be automatically part of this organization. I think that's one of the downfalls of the corporations is stock and the fact that it's alienable. One thing I keep on hearing is about how stock can be sold after 1991, but it is my understanding that after 1991, stock will almost be considered a personal asset of each of us, and we may be able to have it taken from us involuntarily, maybe through some kind of action in court, through a suit or so. And I wish that was one area that more of the 1991 talks would start focusing on. When Kathy was talking about land, one thing that occurred to me in a class I took once is how the village lands were conveyed, and they were conveyed in a patchwork type fashion to where they would get every other town site.
You mean checkerboard.
Okay, checkerboard, right. It's my personal opinion that I think it would be much better if it wasn't in a checkerboard type fashion, but in a, you know, all in big hunks instead of just patchwork. That's about all I have to say.
Yes, maybe I could just add this. You asked about James Bay in northern Quebec. We had the native leaders from James Bay in northern Quebec and other native leaders from Canada come to Anchorage to tell us about their experience. And they made settlements at James Bay in 1975 and then in the Mackenzie Delta in 1978 and then in the Yukon Territory just earlier this year, 1984. And they all did what you suggested they ought to do. They rejected the idea of a shareholders corporation and they all adopted instead a membership corporation that is perpetual and in which every person born into the tribe or the village or the community is automatically an equal, shares equally in the, as a member of the organization, as a member of the tribe, the community, the village. So everybody's taken your advice. And here we are with ANCSA, and we've got to see what you all think about it and then try to see what can be done about it.
Yeah, one other thing I'd like to add is I'm quite glad to see that you're just coming to just everybody else instead of just going to the corporate leadership, because sometimes I do question whether the corporations, well, I should say I question whether my corporation represents the interest of people in my area.
Thank you, Mr. Templeton. I should say that when we had these people from other countries come to Anchorage, they all participated in a big public roundtable discussion, and some of the corporate and native leaders from Alaska were there, and some of them said, look, you did the wise thing in rejecting the shareholder corporation type of setup. So a lot of thinking has gone on since 1971, but you reached the same conclusion as quite a few others. All these pauses give me a chance to write down what the last person said anyway.
Well, I'm Pam Herman. I said I'd testify, and so here I am. I'm not still quite sure what I want to say either. I was going to have something written out. Over the last several years, I've listened to a lot of wonderful spontaneous oratory in public meetings in Northwest Alaska, but I just can't do that myself, so this won't be very artistically put, I don't think.
Just for the record, you're the teacher of this class and,
yes.
a professor at the...
Well, I'm actually not an instructional staff. I'm an administrator. I run a summer honors program for high school students from rural villages who come here during their junior year between their junior and senior year in high school to get a taste of college and the kind of workload that's involved, what it's like to live in the dormitory, et cetera. And we offer a course in the land settlement in that summer program because very few students study the land settlement in their high school classes. That's one of the things I wanted to mention briefly in my testimony. Since you folks didn't come up here and talk, you're going to probably have to listen to me go on at length, but maybe I'll provoke some of you into coming up and responding, at least maybe some of the NANA people. To qualify myself as a witness, since I'm not a shareholder, I wanted to say that I lived in Kotzebue from May of 1975 until September of 1982, about, I guess that's 7 or 8 years. I was gone for a few months in there, but basically lived there pretty much that whole time. I was sent to Kotzebue by Alaska Legal Services as a VISTA lawyer to open a law office there, and that was the first job I had there. After I did that, which I was able to accomplish because I had a lot of community support for opening an office up there, I went to work for Manilik, the nonprofit association running their Johnson O'Malley program, and I did that for a year. I worked as a radio announcer at KOTZ on and off for about 2 years. I published a newspaper for a year for Northwest Alaska. I worked at the Tundra Times for a few months in the summer of 1978 as editor and then as business manager, and then returned to Kotzebue to run the what was then called CETA program. I did that for 2 years. And then I went to work for NANA as John Schaefer's assistant. I did that for a year, and then I ran the NANA Museum of the Arctic for a year, and now I am here at the university as an administrator. So I guess what you'd have to say is that I'm a co-opted community organizer with too much education for my own good and a sort of lifetime supply of culture shock. And I've been interested in as a sort of an anthropological interest in the development of infrastructures and communities. It's been very interesting to be in Kotzebue for the last 8 or 9 years because it's from the time that I arrived there until now, I've seen an enormous development of all kinds of different organizations, both in Kotzebue and out in the outlying villages. And it's a remarkable example of the adaptation of a group to new kinds of institutions. I think NANA is often used as a paradigm of adaptation to modern institutions without losing a lot of the values that made Native culture strong historically. So I've seen a lot of interesting stuff going on up there. I've seen people adapting Western institutions to serve goals that maybe were older than the institutions that they're using. I've also seen some things that didn't work very well, and I say right off the bat that I think the least successful effort to adapt a modern Western institution to a traditional community has been in the educational area. Despite enormous efforts, including sponsoring Senate Bill 35, which is responsible for the creation of rural school districts, that came out of the NANA region. They really were sort of prime movers in the effort to get local control of schools, and yet still the system just doesn't adapt very easily. And the educational system, I think, brings with it more of the value system of the culture that created it than almost any of these other institutions, more than governmental structures, more than corporations even. There's something about the way Western society educates its children that just brings with it all kinds of other lessons that may not be very applicable to the kind of lifestyle that people are going to be living, the kind of things that they need to know. And this isn't only true of the public school system. I think the university has failed as well. Possibly it's just that these kinds of institutions adapt very slowly and that maybe it'll take a little longer, but it's possible, I know it's possible for, not only possible, but it's likely that someone who goes through the public school system and graduates from the university could still never actually take a course where they learn what the land settlement was or how it works. There's nothing required in any of the curricula that will necessarily deal with that. And even if the stuff is required, now I think in Northwest Arctic they require Inupiaq studies for graduation, and that includes a course of some time spent on ANCSA, 6 weeks spent on the land settlement. There's no guarantee that the person who teaches that course actually understands what they're teaching. In Kotzebue, the teacher is very good. In some of the villages, that's true. In some villages, it may be taught by somebody who's only been there for a year and has no idea what's happening, and certainly has no sense of what's going on in that village chronologically. Teachers tend to arrive in a village and think that what they see is what's always been there and not understand how much things have changed. At any rate, what I wanted to talk about, since it's the only thing I really know anything about, is the NANA region and why it seems to have seems to be used often as the example of the most successful region in terms of adapting ANCSA to its own purposes. And I don't, when I say that, I don't mean to sound maybe quite as biased as, although I am biased, I'm very partial to NANA, the people that work there, but it's generally used as an example of a successful adaptation of the corporate structure. And to say if that's true, why is it true, and if it's not true, in what ways have they failed to adapt? I think some of the reasons for the adaptation working are historical and geographical. The region is very has always had, although there were many different tribal groups residing in the Northwest Alaska over the last 10,000 years, there's been a lot of communication. There's certainly the language is the same from one village to the next. There's a lot of communication and trade that's gone on historically. And Kotzebue, the regional center, was a trading center historically for many centuries. So people have always gathered at Kotzebue in the summer for trading and other kinds of activities, social activities. So there was sort of a, already there was a structure up in the region for, to allow for some kind of joint action. For reasons that I don't understand, there was a, because contact with Western culture came later to Northwest Alaska than a lot of other parts of the state. It was as late as 1900 in some places. The first contact on the Upper Kobuk River with any non-natives was not until 1886. So you have a, you're only talking about 100 years of contact, and for the first half of that, the contact was very was minimal. So the traditions were still very strong. The language was very strong at the time of the settlement in most of the villages, and it was only in Kotzebue that there was really a significant, you know. So much white culture that you could say that the culture of the area had really been substantially had changed so much that it was a different culture. In the villages, it seemed that the culture was changing. Certainly, they were adapting the use of a lot of white Western technology, but still the family patterns and the way power structures developed were pretty much according to the tradition that existed before there was any white contact there. That's different from a lot of other areas. So you have a cohesive group of people who have their own traditions pretty much intact at the time of and up until about the early part of the century anyway. There was a there's a group of leaders in the region now who have been in power for ever since before the act was passed, and these the people that I know, I'm speaking specifically of John Schaefer, but of others as well, seem to me, after some pretty close contact, to be really sincere about making the settlement work in the best sense of that word. In other words, not to serve Western corporate goals, but to serve the idea of holding land and retaining land for generations into the future. And the NANA boards consistently has adopted policies that would further that kind of a goal, and they don't have that much confusion about the difference between the need to make a profit and the need to foster certain other values at home. In other words, where some corporations seem to see the need to make a profit as overriding other kinds of cultural values, in NANA there it would appear to me that the leaders sincerely think that the profit goal is a secondary goal. It's you need to make a profit in order to survive as a corporation, but you don't subvert other internal regional goals to the profit. So that all of the most of NANA's in-region investments, for instance, are not there for profit, but for employment purposes or for the development of an economic infrastructure in the region. And there's not, it doesn't bother them overly that their in-region enterprises never make a profit, which they hardly ever do. I mean, they've got enterprises that from the beginning of the corporation have never shown a profit 1 year, but they still are in existence because they serve some other kind of a goal. They make their profit outside the region, and uncertainly in the North Slope, that might be causing some problems because they don't have the same kind of tie to other people's lands, and they're more, you know, they may be just as happy to to do things that they wouldn't do at home on other people's property. But at any rate, in the region, there's not that much conflict. Things that I heard this morning, people suggesting that before, one suggestion was that Doyon perhaps would have been in a better position on this oil refinery loss if they had gone to their shareholders first, and the decision to make that investment was a consensus so that everybody shared the responsibility for the failure. In Nana, that's the way their major mining development was undertaken, in just that way. There were meetings held in every village for several years to discuss whether or not mining should be undertaken in the region, and the decision wasn't made to do that until the need for jobs forced people to decide that mining should be developed in the region, and that was a group decision. I'm not sure that's going to make that much difference if the Red Dog project end up losing a lot of money. I don't think that that's going to save the Nana management, though, from the repercussions of unhappy shareholders, because they could say that they were ill-informed, they were told it would make a profit, and then it didn't. But still, Nana's tried to do those kinds of things. They haven't always been. I'm sure there are many shareholders who feel that they haven't been as honest or forthcoming as they might have, but I think a lot of the things that I hear other people saying their corporation should have done, Nana's has tried to do. Nana's developed land policies. I brought the copy here to enter into the record, which are very different from what I've heard other people say their corporations are doing. Nana doesn't require shareholders to pay anything for the use of Nana land. You don't need a permit, you don't need anything. If you're a Nana shareholder and you want to use Nana land in the region, you just go ahead and use it. If you're going to build a structure on it, then you have to go tell the Nana land people where it is, but otherwise there's no limit. But you don't get land. Nana's not handing out land to individuals. And I've heard a lot of people say that they thought that's what the settlement would result in, is individual land holdings. I really question for myself whether that's the way to go about dealing with the issue of getting land into making land available for shareholders to use, because once you do that, you've lost any kind of tribal control over what happens on that land. As soon as it enters individual hands as free, fee simple land, that's fine for this generation, but maybe in another generation that land will be turned into a subdivision and a whole lot of people will move into it and move their trailers on it or something. I don't see where putting native land in individual hands is necessarily the solution if you're looking down the road. But at any rate, Nana has developed in consistent with the overall corporate goals that they've formulated for themselves right after they were established. They developed land use policies that implement those goals. They've really tried to go about doing this in the most consistent and thorough way that they could, and they have tried to involve shareholders as much as possible in all of these decisions, and they've had meetings in all of the villages every year to discuss these things. So that's sort of on the plus side. Nana's also taken advantage of the economic power that they've got as a successful corporation with some political savvy to get a lot of benefits for their shareholders that didn't come directly through the settlement. Frank Ferguson is famous for his ability to get public works projects in his region. I'm sure a lot of people in other regions don't like that about him, but it's great if you live up there, because he really delivers for his voters. And not, I don't think, in a bad way. I think he's really done a lot of good for people up there. So they've parlayed their economic power into enormous political influence. They have a terrific influence in the governor's office. They've used with the power that came through the settlement to help shareholders in ways that were indirectly related to the settlement itself. So all of these good things are happening. Nana people talk about that. A few years ago, they were talking about it a lot. They were saying, we went around and got all these things. We got this housing, we've got schools, we've got sewer and water, telephones, the whole thing, what Willie talked about when he came to speak to our class, and everybody's worse off than they were. We've got the highest suicide rate in the state, which is the highest in the nation, among the highest in the world. The rate of accidental deaths is even worse, and that's almost like suicide because a lot of it's alcohol related. The incidence of family violence is appalling, even though people are really trying to do something about it up there. There's just this whole slew of social problems, and it seems like the more money you get, the more dependent people are on cash and the less able they are to take care of themselves. So They said, what have we done? You know, in our efforts to make things better, we've maybe made things worse. So the leadership itself started trying to address those issues, the issues of fundamental values. What are we doing here? What is our purpose? And they went out and tried to talk to shareholders about those things. And I was privileged to, really privileged, I think, to be able to go with the NANA leadership to, on the Village Spirit trip in 1980, or whenever it was. From village to village, the leaders spent 2 or 3 days in each village meeting with everybody, meeting with school groups and older people, talking about what the fundamental values of the culture were and how they could be reinforced, and how all of these negative impacts of the settlement and all of the kinds of stuff that Mike Gaffney talked about in his testimony earlier this morning, all the other kinds of developments that occurred that weren't directly related to ANCSA, but which had a terrific effect on the village, you know, the life in the village. So they're even trying to address the more spiritual side of things. And I really think they're sincere. Then the question is still, there are dissatisfied shareholders up there. There are people who feel disenfranchised. Even though NANA does try to talk to shareholders about all of their decisions, it's not as if John Schaefer has a one-on-one conversation with every one of the 500 shareholders, and so there are always people who feel like nobody asked them about this or that, and it's true. You know, there is the whole corporate structure relies on a sort of oligarchical arrangement where you have people in power and people who put them in power, or people who acquiesce to their having that power. It's like a little ruling class that perpetuates itself. Now they're benign in their efforts, and they're very sincere, but there's still questions in some people's minds about whether they really have any influence over what NANA does. And yet NANA's much more responsive than some of the other corporations. So it's just hard. It's just hard. It's like, is it possible? Even in the best case scenario, is it really working? I guess what I'd say is that if NANA is probably one of the best cases, it certainly has been making a profit, although not a huge profit. It hasn't taken a loss in a number of years. Its net worth increases every year. It's tried to further all of the kinds of goals that the land settlement could be interpreted as having intended to happen, and they've tried to minimize the negative impacts that could occur up there. But still, people aren't satisfied. I think one way to look at it is to think that there was something had to be done, that if there hadn't been a settlement with the corporations and everything else, there would have been no settlement, which was a real possibility at the time, in the mid-60s, that was looking like it might actually happen. Or there might have been a much, much smaller settlement. And to think that, I don't know what the deal was in Washington when the act was passed. I don't know who wanted which parts of the act. I'm sure that the 20-year moratorium was something that Congress imposed, and that it would have been much longer if the Native negotiators could have had their way. The idea of whether of corporations, I don't know. Maybe other people do. These are questions that I ask myself. Whose idea was it that you would use a corporation instead of a membership organization, for instance? The idea of giving the land in enclaves as reservations was not really a possibility. So that's not much profit in discussing whether that would have been better or not. But perhaps my final evaluation of whether the settlement was a success or not will come when we find out how much latitude Congress will allow Native people in their efforts to amend the act to get the kind of structure that they now think they want after having had several years of experience with this corporate structure. If Congress says, well, the amount of land that you got and the amount of money you got, that can't be changed, but how you deal with the land and the money is up to you, and if you want to change that, go ahead. If you want to give over your land to your IRA councils, or if you want to divvy up the land to individuals and basically terminate yourselves so that each individual has a bunch of acres and there is no more corporation, the corporation would be dissolved. If Congress will allow people that level of self-determination, then I would say that as much as it's possible, the act was was a reasonable success. But if Congress says, no, this is the deal, you took the stick and it happened to be the wrong end, and now it's 1991 and you want to come in and change the terms of the settlement and we say you can't, then I'd say that the thing was a hose job from day one. And anything that you could do to make trouble would be probably in order. There are some aspects of the act that really do look like a termination. If it's possible for a corporation to dissolve and hand out its land to individual shareholders, that seems like a termination to me. Although village council won't be terminated. It'll still have whatever kind of power it would have, but it wouldn't have any jurisdiction over any land, so it's hard to say that that's much power. I probably have a lot more that I could say, but maybe I've provoked somebody to respond or have some reactions. I think I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Herman.
Coming up, that might point out some of the problems in the claims settlement. I was raised in a primarily non-native community in the Otna region, but I'm a shareholder in the Bristol Bay Corporation, and I found that was kind of my identity, and I know that it wasn't just me personally, because one of my sisters isn't included in the act, and she felt like she wasn't as native because she wasn't part of it. And I see that problem, and I think that they should be included. I like to see, just like Kathy said, I like to see that there is interest for these people, because there are so many of them, and there will be so many if we don't take care of them soon enough. And another example is my mom was interested in developing her land that she'd received, and she was looking into a deal that she could have a house built on her land in exchange for some land to a nearby village corporation. And then a different non-native party showed interest in developing on her land, and she was considering exchanging his services for a part of her land, even though he wasn't native. And I told her, why don't you give it to the village corporation? It's for natives. You shouldn't give it away. And she said that they intended to turn around and sell it to white people anyways. And I don't think that on that level there should be the option to give away. I don't think, on the personal level, if the land is more of a personal, if it's yours, then I think that, if we allow people to do that, then they should be able to take advantage of selling it. It's their own land. But with the regional the village corporations, I think they should be limited with what they could do with the land. I think that they should have more responsibilities to the natives. And I don't know if this is just a problem exclusive in the Bristol Bay region or if it's statewide, I'm not sure. And it's not really much to say, but I hope I can contribute. I'm happy to see all that's being done for the natives, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Lewis.
Hi, my name is Alphonse Dementa. I'm a stockholder from Tocatili and Doyon Regional. And I'd just like to talk about the developed and undeveloped lands for the regional and village corporations. Village corporations are very culture related. They have more problems dealing every day with the people. Regionals are more profit orientated, and they are kind of separated from the people. But the law, ANCSA, gave a big burden on village corporations. Because they are culture related, they are going to have more problems in 1991 dealing with taxes. Village corporations have no subsurface rights. Most village corporations have a few acres of timber. They have, even if they do have farmland, they have no way to turn a profit. They have no way to protect themselves in 1991. They are, well, why is the taxes so important to me? Because I live in Nenana, and the other day I seen for the first time what a corporate city could do, incorporated city. I thought the city limits extended just a few miles out. I went home the other day and they had trails, roads, 3-4 miles out past the airport in areas that I never even thought was city land. In any city land, and a profit corporation owns land in that, then it's taxable. And they could very well lose that if they have no way to make a profit. I have a problem with why they gave subsurface rights to regional corporations. I think that the land there was in the village corporations should have the same rights as any other corporation. It should have been equal. Maybe the regional corporation could have been the one to develop it, but the village corporation should have a say on whatever minerals and stuff came out of their region. They don't even have gravel rights. They can't even build their own roads. They have to get permission from the regional corporations. It's just as a business major, that this will suffocate most of the village corporations. I don't see how even the ones that are profit right now can deal with these taxes when the 20 years is up. I think most of the village corporations have to get some kind of maybe a tax-free on their undeveloped lands. They have to have some kind of tax status that if they're undeveloped, whether it becomes in a borough, in a city, or whatever, that if it's undeveloped, they will not have to pay taxes on it, whether they're a profit corporation or not. Thank you.
Thank you for that presentation, Mr. Dementiev.
My name is Jeff Nelson. I'm from the Aniak area. I'm the shareholder of the Chilista region. And I would just like to talk about education in my area. It's, I'm in the Cuspuck School District, and I was reading the Thunder Drums a couple of days ago, and I heard some disappointing news to me. It was our superintendent was planning to give out bonuses. You know, there was a supply of money that was he had just laying around that was not being used for anything, you know, towards education. And it was, I think, 1.5 million. And, well, the appropriation of 1,000 to all the members of the Cuspark School District is, I don't think a very good idea. I think I would like to see more Native involvement in the educational area in the rural districts. And if the Native corporations could somehow get involved, I think then the power would be there to make some changes. And right now, our superintendent, he's from Texas, and he doesn't know much about people in my area. He's lived there for a while, but you can never really understand what people, go through to in their lives, and because he's never grown up in that area, and he's non-native, and he's bought computers and airplanes, and those things they're all right, but people, they have spiritual needs also. They have other needs besides just making a profit. And if we can get more Native involvement in administering our own affairs, I think we can, then we could probably bring in some other things like computers and planes and luxury items. Right now, I think natives need to be more concerned about their livelihood, their future. I know that the subsistence lifestyle will probably, not last forever. And especially with the population increase in Alaska right now, the population is over the 500,000 mark, and more people are moving in monthly, and I think there's cause for concern with such an increase, and the sooner we get Native involvement in our own affairs, I think the better off we'll be to handle the large influx of non-natives. So I would like to see more corporation involvement in those matters. And that's about all I have to say right now.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson.
First of all, I wanted to commend you on the things that you've been doing for the natives. My name is Olinka Nikolai from Kuitluk, a member of the Chalista Corporation. And I've been very much concerned about the future of the Alaska natives and their land, because I'm supposedly well educated, but I'm not so in the area of ANSCA and knowing about the government or whatever's going to be happening to the natives in the future. And I'm a prime example of many, many people in the villages, because the year the ANSCA came out and the people were applying for the land, I was overseas and my parents didn't know anything about the ANSCA claims or whatever it curtailed. And that applies to especially many, many people in the Bethel area who are mainly Yupik speakers. Stop shaking. The reason I've gone to school like I have, hoping that I'd be done before 1991, was to maybe ensure that ANSCA education was emphasized to the Alaska Natives, because acculturation of their culture into the mainstream is rapidly growing too fast, that there's really no way to keep it in control, sort of. But because there's many people who don't know what the concept of ANSCA entails, I feel that maybe especially for, like I was earlier saying, the time ANSCA was, the land claims were applied for, I was overseas, and I have a family of 13, and only 3 in my family were able to get land at the time, and because of not understanding what this new concept was, and even up to now, I feel that the education in the high schools, or even in the grade schools, education in ANSCA or the future is not hardly there at all, like Pam was saying. And I remember I wrote for David K. Nicolai Scholarship from the Chelista Corporation, and along with that letter I wrote out this concern and wondered what my corporation was doing for the education of the Chelista Corporation natives on 1991 and the land claims and everything. But they sent me the application form for the David K. Nicolai Scholarship, but they didn't say anything about the future of the Alaska Natives and their land claims, because this concept is so different, especially to the older people and even young people. We've never known to have a piece of land. The whole land was God's creation for us, and it was for us to use, for anybody to use. And just knowing, especially with the paperwork and everything of owning land, is a truly abstract concept that a lot of the native people have not accepted or learned about, because it's also sort of, because it is abstract, I think that's one of the things that needs to be emphasized in education of the natives in any corporation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Nicolai.
My name is Muffy McKernan. I testified a little bit earlier this morning. I'd like to add a little bit of I am a teacher. I have taught in the communities of Unalaska and in the community of Holy Cross. And I've listened to some comments about education, and I agree in a lot of ways. Education in this state is failing the Native community. And I think that I would really like to see greater cooperation between the school districts and the corporations in looking at what the goals of our schools should be. And I think that both organizations, but probably in particular the school districts, are going to have to give in on some of that. And I think that there really needs to be cooperation between those two in order for this concept to work and for the people to know what's happening and to become educated about what's happening. And I think that the teachers do need to know more about what's happening as well as the Native people.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Albert Larson. I'm a shareholder of BB&C, and I'd say something about the education of a corporation with schooling, say high school education, or even before that, junior high. When I was in high school, I didn't have any idea of what a corporation was really about, except for they send me money a couple of times a year for Christmas shopping or something like that. Then their annual meetings I'd go to, they'd be something like just go there and eat donuts and sit around or something like that. But after a couple of years ago, I got a little interested on my corporation. What was it all about? And I sat down and I learned that it wasn't only a place where I can get donuts or money for Christmas shopping. Also, I learned that it's a corporation that was interested in what their shareholders wanted and what their interests were. And from what I've seen so far, the corporation has been helping me out quite a bit. Also, I see that the corporation makes the people feel that they are Native, even still. That what I think helps them is that BB&C is under Bristol Bay Native Corporation. I think it makes the people feel that they feel good under that name, Native Corporation, that they belong to a Native corporation. But right now I'm still learning more about a corporation and what it can do. That's about all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Larson.
I'm going to say something for my grandmother, because she said, if you don't get involved, you have no right to complain, because I was always complaining about our corporations, Bering Straits and Unclick Village Native Corporation. And my name's Vicki Hikes, and I'm from Unclick, but my family also came down from Old Kobuk 200 years ago to Unclick. I want to talk about education. Unclick has always had a good school system, even under BIA. We had very good teachers, but it didn't help us any under ANGSA. It didn't do us any good. Most of the people under 35 years old in my hometown have at least 1 or 2 years of college, and a lot of them are college graduates. That hasn't helped us at all. we're still losing money. Most of the problems, I feel, were caused because you took a culture based on a communal society where all resources were shared, and you interjected the corporate structure. The result, the greed, which is a basic human emotion, which was suppressed by the community and the society in which our ancestors lived, is now unchecked, and there is nothing under ANCSA which checks anyone who steals money from the corporation. There's nothing that can be done. We've had that happen to our corporation over and over again, my village corporation. And they'll fire the man, or men, it's actually men, and 2 months later they'll give him a job because he has a family and he has to support them or go on welfare. Well, I'd prefer he went on welfare, because they have no right to take our money and build themselves a house or buy a new boat and buy themselves motors or snow machines. And it happens over and over again. And one man in particular has been fired 3 times, and he just got rehired last month. And there's nothing anyone can do about it. We're all shareholders. But we don't really have any say in who they hire. I mean, we can get him fired, which we've managed to do every time he's done something, but he always gets rehired, so what's the point? And they took the house from this one person, but he still has his snow machines. And it didn't do the old people any good. I feel ANCSA really has not benefited the old people. It hasn't done them any good, and they're the ones who deserve it. I don't think I deserve it. I just happen to be Native. But they're the ones who went through all the changes. They're the ones who, you know, went through the most change in their lifetime. I mean, my grandmother is 75 years old, and she tells me about stories about what her reaction to the first time she saw an airplane and a boat. And I feel they deserve more than they're getting. They're not going to get anything. By the time 1991 rolls around, most of them will be dead. They're not really benefiting from something that I think they deserve more than anyone. As for what I was saying earlier about education, I went to a very good college in the East Coast, and I have a degree in economics. I studied economics not because I was very interested in it, but because of ANCSA. I wanted to understand how the corporate structure works. And I learned, but I feel no motivation to go back to where I'm from and do anything about it, because I am totally disillusioned in the way it is run. I'm disappointed in the natives themselves, in myself, because my grandmother always told me that you had to be better, you had to be smarter, because you're different, you're a minority, and you're also white, and you had to take the best of both worlds and stick them together. And I don't feel that most natives in the corporate structure are doing that. I think they're emulating the worst possible things in our modern society and taking that and putting it into their corporations. They're making decisions that will affect their great-grandchildren, and they're not really taking that into consideration. It's always today, or maybe next year, the They want to look good on paper now. They're not thinking ahead far enough. And sure, they're worried about 1991, but they should have been worried about that from the beginning. As far as taxes, I wonder sometimes if the land claims was just a big ripoff. I wonder if the government realized that by taxing the land, eventually they'd get it all back. Because how are most corporations going to pay taxes on that land? It's such a huge amount of land. I just don't see how they expected people to be able to pay taxes on it. Fortunately, native allotments are exempt from taxation because they're under the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And I inherited some land, so I'll have some. But what about the other people who aren't as lucky? I really do believe that most of the land will revert back to the federal government or the state government because of corporations' inability to pay taxes in the future. It might not happen in 1991, but it will happen. If I'm speaking, assuming that natives remain in control of their corporations past 1991, which I don't think my corporation will be able to do because of the disillusionment of its stockholders.
Thank you, Ms. How do you spell your last name, Ms.? Oh, H-Y-K-S.
No, K-E-S.
Sorry, H-Y-K-E-S. Thank you very much. Well, these presentations have been very thought-provoking, so if there are any more that you have, I'd certainly like to hear from you, because I've been very impressed at the knowledge of the issues that you've shown this afternoon, and you've raised some very good points.